Shalom, welcome to Ask JTF. This is Chaim Ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to elevating the souls of Simcha Chasdai, Pesach Vansir, Ruven Hoffman, Bari Hoffman, Harab Meir Kahana, and Yosef Ben Meir. Before we get to our many questions from our great JTFers, I'm going to continue with what we spoke about last week in terms of our contacts with members of the Knesset and political leaders in Israel, because we continue to have contacts with them. And I just think it's interesting, and I think our JTF members are interested in this. I write to and speak to members of the Knesset. I actually communicate with them on Facebook and with political leaders in Israel and with rabbis in Israel. And you'd be surprised who some of these people are. None of them are on the level of cabinet ministers, the highest politically are members of the Knesset from small parties. But I actually communicate, and it's not a lot, I only communicate with three people who are currently in the Knesset. I have tried to communicate with other people, but they don't answer me. What's interesting is these three people who are in the Knesset, they know about my history. I've told them about my history because I want to get them to help me also make Aliyah. I want to get them to help me get into Israel. And so I've told them my whole history. I've told them about the bombings and about my prior convictions. And I've told them I spent time in prison and that I'm banned from Israel. So they know my whole history, and still they answer every time I write to them and communicate with them, they write to me. And the interesting thing is, I think the reason why they're doing this is because, first of all, they know that we have a lot of videos up and that we reach a certain number of people. And I think they want our help. As much as we can help in terms of our Hebrew videos, in terms of our Hebrew forums and Hebrew Facebook pages, and our Hebrew main page, now our Hebrew news page. I think they want us to help because they know that thousands of Israeli voters come to us or are reached by us every week. And with the election coming up on March 17th, I think that's something that they are interested in. They also, I think, were impressed with some of the suggestions we made. I mentioned last week some of the things that we suggested. We suggested that certain small political parties get together and run under one list. It didn't work out for a variety of reasons, but the fact that we made the suggestions, the fact that we were in contact with these people, the fact that I was able to write to these people and explain my reasons and lay out a scenario for running a successful campaign, they were quite impressed with what we presented to them, the arguments we presented, and our knowledge of Israeli politics and our knowledge of how to persuade people. These are seasoned politicians, and they were actually quite impressed with what we presented to them. And I think because of that, they actually consult with us before making decisions now. They actually have been turning to us and consulting. Do you think we should speak to this guy? Do you think maybe this guy's a good guy to put on the list for our Knesset campaign? It's amazing what has happened. They actually put out feelers and consult with us on what to do, and we try to answer them as best we can. And by the way, I'm not the only person in our Hebrew movement that knows a lot about Israeli politics and that speaks to them. We have some other people who are also good at this, who also speak to them. In any event, I think it's important because I'll explain to you why I think this is very important. These are minor parties. If they get into the Knesset, though, they can have a big impact on what happens in the next few years during the next Knesset of Israel, the 20th Knesset of Israel. It'll be the 20th Israeli parliament, the 20th Knesset. Why can they have a big impact? Because according to all the polls, there is a very, very close race right now between the block of parties that are part of what we call the phony right, Hayamin HaMezuyaf in Hebrew, which means the phony right, the Likud and the Jewish Home Party, and the other parties that like that. That's the phony right. And then you have the open left. The open left parties like the Labor Party and Meretz. Between those two blocks, there's a very, very close competition now, almost even in the polls. So if we get one of the smaller parties on the right in, one of these small parties on the right in, and even if they have only four seats, you have to have a minimum of four seats now because they raise the threshold. The minimum threshold to get in, you have to have at least 3.25% of the vote, and that comes to 4 seats out of 120 seats in the Israeli parliament. That means you've got to get a minimum of 4 out of 120 seats to get in now. Once upon a time, you only have to get 1 seat. You only have to get 1% of the vote, and that came to 1 seat. Now they've raised the minimum because they want to get these, they want these small parties, they don't want these small parties to get in anymore. So the big parties got together and raised the minimum that you need to get in. And so now, if you want to get representation in the Knesset, you have to win at least 4 seats out of 120 seats. And that's not easy for a small party to do. But if we get one of these small parties that are communicating with us right now, if one of them gets in, they can be the balance of power between the two blocks, between the phony right block and the left block. And so if they turn against somebody or they swing against somebody, that can be the balance of power that determines whether or not a government falls or a government coalition is assembled. Who knows? I mean, potentially that could happen. It may be that that won't happen. It may be that they won't need this small, these small political leaders that we're speaking to now. They may not need them, but there have been cases in Israeli history where they, where people in this position have had, because they're the balance of power, made a big difference. So you never know. You never know. In any event, we want to have an impact. And so we're speaking to them. They are impressed with what we're presenting to them. They actually turn to us now for our advice. They actually write, Chaim, thank you so much for your advice. Thank you so much. Very interesting points you make. They, you know, if an average person, let's say in the United States, let's put this in American, in the context of American politics. Let's say an average person writes to their senator or congressman. The chance of that senator or congressman personally responding every time they write, back and forth, dozens of times, personally responding, not having their staff do it, but personally responding. The chances of that happening are very slim. Usually they don't do that. And in Israel, it's the same thing. A Knesset member will have one of his staff people give you a form letter and answer with a form letter. That's usually what happens. And some of the bigger leaders in Israel that we try to turn to have done that. They just respond with form letters. We don't come there with millions, giving them millions of dollars. They don't take us seriously. But these smaller political leaders and smaller parties do take it seriously. And we've been back and forth, we've been communicating with them back and forth on a daily basis now for weeks on Facebook and sometimes on the telephone. And it's really fascinating. I've actually had phone conversations with members of the Knesset that have been pretty extensive phone conversations. And of course, communication by email and by Facebook. So what does this mean? This means that maybe we have some chance of throwing in our views and having some influence on the process, number one. Maybe. Some chance. I'm not going to overrate this. Obviously, these politicians mainly are interested in their own political future, so, you know, I don't want to overrate our ability to do things. But in addition to that, of course, these leaders, because they'll be in the balance of power, maybe they could help me get into Israel also, eventually. Maybe they could play a role in helping me to get into Israel. So I just wanted you to know what's going on. I thought you'd find it interesting. I thought you'd find it fascinating. It really is fascinating. I wish I could tell you all the ins and outs. You wouldn't know the names of the minor parties that I'm speaking about that I'm trying to get to people to meet and communicate with, and some of them have already had meetings. You wouldn't even know the names if I told you the names. You wouldn't be familiar with it because it's really inside baseball. Most Israelis don't even know the names of some of these minor political parties. But people in the religious world, in the yeshiva world, would know them perhaps. But the actual impact of them getting together could be important. It could be the difference between them getting in the Knesset and not getting in the Knesset. So I wish I could tell you all the details. If I told you the details, if I told our great JTFers the details, that'd be the end of my contacts with these people. It would be the end. It would be over. So the only thing I can do is speak to you in generalities right now. That's all I can do. But believe me, we're in touch with the people in the Knesset and political leaders and consultants and people that are working on campaigns for these small parties. We're in touch with them. And they take our advice seriously. they argue back and forth with us if they disagree with something we say, or if they agree with something we say, or if sometimes they say, oh, that's a good idea, I didn't think of it that way. That goes back and forth. We have those back and forth communications, and that's, I don't know, I just think that's interesting. If ever I did get into Israel, you never know. I could eventually run with these people myself for the Knesset. So, and running, representing our Hebrew movement. So all of this is very interesting. And again, these people are impressed with some of the creative ideas we've come up with. I just thought our fellow JTFers would be interested in that. And, you know, so I just thought I'd take 10 minutes in the beginning and explain that to you once again with a little more detail. In addition to that, of course, let me give you a deadline here. January 29th, Thursday, January 29th, everybody's got to present their Knesset list, their final Knesset lists. By then, certainly, we're going to know exactly who's running, what the situation is, and then we're going to start moving with our video campaign. We're going to begin a big video campaign to try to influence the outcome of the election. It's a lesser of the evils proposition. The people running, for us, it's a lesser of the evils. We don't have people running with our platform in this race. So it's not an ideal situation, but we're going to go after the parties and the leaders that we think are a threat to Israel. So we're going to begin a video campaign against them with Hebrew videos, mainly Hebrew videos. I may translate some into English, but generally speaking, it's going to be Hebrew, and we're going to need your help. We're going to need you to help us promote those videos so that we get as many views as possible, so that as many Israeli voters see that before the election. We're going to need your help on that. That's something we're going to try to do, and we're going to be very consumed by that and very busy with that until the March 17th Knesset elections in Israel. Will it have an impact in the end? Who knows? Who knows? We're going to try our best. We have to try our best. And we'll see. We'll see. In addition to that, of course, as you know, as I've been saying all along, after the March 17th Israeli Knesset elections, our focus will then move toward the English videos to influence the presidential election in the United States for 2016. That becomes the next election that we want to influence. So we're going to begin a campaign on behalf of Ted Cruz and against the phony pseudo-conservative. I don't even know if you call them pseudo-conservatives. Someone like Jeb Bush I don't even know if he pretends to be a conservative. I mean, he's just a complete joke. Of anybody who considers him, I'm not saying he's a joke in terms of his potential to get the Republican nomination. The Republican establishment loves him, but him portraying himself as anything but a leftist who wants to open up our borders is a joke. It's just a joke. He's a big government, big spending, left-wing phony. And Rand Paul is even further to the left than he is. So we've got some really bad people in the Republican campaign, Republican Party. And then, of course, we're going to be going after Hillary Clinton. So we got a lot to do. After the March 17th election, you're going to see the English video campaign open. We're going to be focusing heavily on that because I really think it's important that that the truth be told before the presidential election in 2016. We may not be able to influence the outcome. I don't know. Or we may not have a big influence on the outcome. But again, I think we have an obligation to try. That's my view. I think we have an obligation to raise our voices and try. And it's never a waste. When you do something good, and when you try to achieve something good, it's never a waste, because Hashem, God, Hashem sees this. Hashem sees what we're doing. And you never know when Hashem will do something good for the causes and the things we believe in and the people that we love and care about. You never know when Hashem will repay us when we make sacrifices and do things and stand for the truth and are principled. It's never a waste. Even if you lose in the end, it's never a waste. So we're going to do our best to stand up for the truth, to stand up for what's right, to stand up for what's moral, to stand up for what's principled, both in Israel and in America. Until March 17th in Israel. After March 17th, we're going to move on to the American presidential election. And of course, after March 17th, I'm going to continue to try to maintain contacts with these Knesset members, if they're still in the Knesset after the election. I don't know if they're going to, I don't know if they're going to still be in the Knesset after the election. We'll see. If they are, we'll continue to try to influence things. If not, And we'll try to find some other means of trying to influence things. And of course, we'll always be doing Hebrew videos to wake people up as well in Israel. So we're going to need your help. And here's how you help us. Number one, when you see us put up Hebrew or English videos, and I haven't been putting up, I've done a lot of Hebrew videos. I have not put them on the English forum because I don't know, because I thought you don't speak Hebrew and we're not translating them. And so, you know, I just gave you the English. I haven't been, for a while, I haven't put up Hebrew videos that we do because if there's no translation, I feel, I don't know. I just feel like it's taking up a lot of space and how many people in the English forum really would understand it. But we may change that because we want those videos to get as much play as possible, so we're going to want you to help us with them. So we may start putting our Hebrew election videos up again on the English forum. But if you see our videos, help us promote those videos everywhere. Help us on Facebook, on YouTube, everywhere. Please promote those videos. That's the first thing. Second thing, please join our great news page. Shlomo has turned our news page into a magnificent news page where you get facts and information, a collection of stories that you will not see anywhere else. It's true that he obviously gets his news and his information from all the sources that you can find on the internet and everywhere else. But please remember that Shlomo goes through hundreds and hundreds of news sites and finds the things that you wouldn't have time. You wouldn't be able to spend all your time finding these things like Shlomo. Shlomo's an expert at this. And so Shlomo and people who help him putting up things on the English page have put together an excellent news site. Our English news site is updated daily with new news and new information. You definitely should check it at least every day. At least every day you should be checking the English news site. Join the English news site, sign up for the English news site, join the English news site, and comment. Comment, vote in our polls, and comment on the articles. The articles, we have new articles all the time. Comment, go through the articles, put your comments on there. Your comments on there will get on the search engines. You're helping us, you're boosting us with the search engines when you go on there and when you participate and make the site more active with comments. So, again, we have an excellent English news page. Join it and participate in it. That's the second thing you could do in addition to helping us with the videos. And the third and final thing, as you know, obviously, we need as much financial support as possible. If we had a multi-million dollar budget, I'm telling you, within 1 year we'd be a mass movement. We would change Jewish history. Within one year. We don't have that. But we still, with whatever we have, we are trying to change things. The more support we get, the more people we can reach, the more influence we can have, the more we can do good for Am Yisrael, for the Jewish people, and for the world. The more good we can do to make this a better world. So please, help us. Every check, every money order, every cash donation sent through the regular mail to our post office. Those of you who want to send checks and money orders and cash donations to our post office through the regular mail, very, very helpful. Every single donation makes a big difference. There are others who believe it's more convenient to do it online. That's fine too. It makes no difference to us. To us, it makes no difference. Some believe it's more convenient through the regular mail. Some believe it's more convenient online with your credit card. For us, it's the same thing. Any way you want to do it is fine with us. If you want to do it with your credit card, you just go to the donate button on the Hebrew main page, which is hayamin.org. On the top, there's, in English, it says donate. There's a donate button on the Hebrew main page, hayamin.org, and you can very conveniently make a donation with your credit card. If you prefer to do it with checks, money orders, or cash donations to the post office box, that's also, for us, it makes no difference. It's the same thing. And it really makes a big difference. God bless the wonderful people in JTF that are helping us. God bless you. God bless you. God bless your loved ones in this world and in the next. All right. I thought I would share that with our people because I think you're interested in what we're doing. And hopefully there'll be a lot more news to share with you in the upcoming weeks and months. Let's hope so, God willing. And now let's go to our questions from our great JTFers. And we start out with Our great friend Wandering Samurai 81, who writes, and I quote, "Der Chaim, are you aware of the creepypasta stories on YouTube? Are any of them real?" Unquote. No, of course not. Creepypasta stories are horror stories. For those of you who don't know about it, they're just fictional horror stories. They're not real. They're meant to frighten people, and they're completely fictional. Thank you, Wandering Samurai. We go now to our other great friend, Joe Gutfeld, who writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim, do you have any recent funny stories of what happened to you on the New York City subways? What is your favorite subway line? Thanks," unquote. There are always things happening on the New York City subway system. I could tell you, last week, I get into a subway car, and there are a group of three young black men screaming on the top of their lungs. And by the way, I have headphones on. I'm listening to something. I'm not, you know, because when I don't waste time on the subway. Either I read, or I'm going to listen to something. I'm going to listen to a shiur on the Torah or something. I'm going to do something constructive. I don't want to just waste my time staring into thin air when I'm traveling on a bus or a subway or anywhere, because I do a lot of traveling. And even though I had headphones on, these three, and I was at one end of the subway car, they're all the way at the other end of the subway car. And I could hear their screaming on the top of their lungs like savages, and using the most filthy language and screaming, "That white punk, he just a white punk, and he just a white," and then all the dirty language, the filthiest language, talking about someone that they have worked, that they work with. You know, they get jobs, these savages. They get jobs. Decent, educated, nice white people can't find work, and these beasts get jobs. Anyway, that's the affirmative action world that we live in this country now for 50 years now. But they're screaming on the top of their lungs against this white punk and this white, and that's the very nice word. I'm not going to tell you, I don't have to tell you. I'm sure our JTFers unfortunately know all of the dirty words that they use. Just the filthiest language, screaming and yelling and cursing and just disgusting. Absolutely disgusting. And then the next stop, we have actually two stops. Nobody gets on. And then the next stop, and this was in the evening. This is at night. I'm coming home at night. And the next stop, and the subway car is empty except for the four of us, these three young blacks, on the end, and they were, I don't know, they were about 19, 20 years old. These three young blacks, one end of the subway car, and I'm sitting at the other end. And all of a sudden, after two stops, this smelly, big, black bum gets on. Real unbelievable odor. I mean, just stinks like, if any of you who have ever been around these homeless schwarzes, I mean, just the smelly, filthy, disgusting smell, he gets on. And these three guys, you know, they say, "Woo, what that be?" You know, and they are just absolutely, I mean, they're, you know, they couldn't, and he was close to them. They decided to get off the train. They decided to get off the train and they wanted to run to the next car. They couldn't get, the door was locked. They wanted to go through the, you know, from one car to another. But the doors, they couldn't do it. The door was closed between the cars. So they had to get off on the subway platform again and try to run to the next subway car, try to run to the door of the next subway car. I hope people understand what I'm describing here. By the time they decided to get off and run, and after they're cursing and saying, you know, all these other things, cursing and screaming, and by the time they finally got off the train and decided to run to the, it was too late. The other subway car door closed on them, and they were stuck on the subway platform. And this was an outdoor subway platform. And it was an extremely cold. It was a brutally cold night, with wind chills that were close to zero. This was brutally cold, and it was late at night. Where it wasn't that late, but it was, you know, you wait 20, 25 minutes for a train, for the next train. So they were stuck in the cold on the outside platform, and couldn't get back into the train. I loved it. One of their black bros came in and, in effect, chased them off the train with his stink, with his fashtunkene tuchus coming on there. They left the subway car and were stuck on the subway platform in the brutal cold wind, having to wait 20, 25 minutes for the next subway, car. And you could see they were angry. I mean, they were angry, and oh, I loved it. I love seeing that. So that's just another story, subway story. What can I tell you? You asked for my favorite subway line. I hate the subway. I hate the New York City subway system. It's a terrible subway. It's a terrible system. The people, most of the people who work in it are not human. Just savages who get huge salaries and deserve nothing and only get their jobs because of affirmative action. I'd say probably the least annoying train that I've seen is the number 6 train in Manhattan, even though it's the most crowded line. It's definitely the most crowded, but I found that it usually runs better than the other lines, you know, even though there are problems on all the subway lines. I think the number 6 in Manhattan runs better than the other subway lines, in my opinion. Thank you, Joe. And we move on now to our other great friend, Smash Islam, who writes, and I quote, "Some Muslim boys are forced into bestiality to join manhood. Khomeini had muta with 4-year-old girl in Catholic Church is stigmatized for pedophilia," unquote. Well, you know, the Muslims, the hideous sexual practices that they have, all you have to do is just look at the founder of their religion. The most holy, the most sacred person to them, the founder of their religion, Muhammad, married a 6-year-old girl. He was in his 50s. I think he was 53, 54 years old. And so he's a guy in his 50s like I am. I'm in my late 50s. He was, I think, in his early 50s. So he's a guy like my age, marrying a 6-year-old girl. A 6-year-old girl, Aisha. And the hadith teaches us that he had sex with her when she was 9 years old. I mean, this is just, that's the founder of their religion. An open pedophile. Who's proud of, very proud that he's a pedophile. He was a pedophile, he was a rapist, he was a murderer, he was a thief. You know, he advocated genocide against all non-Muslims. That's the founder of their religion. So how can you expect anything normal from such a warped, twisted, sick group of people that would follow a religion like that? Thank you, Smash Islam. And we move on now to the great Chicago Jew, who writes, and I quote, "Happy Martin Luther King Day to the most overrated man of the 20th century, a man who initiated mass rioting, hated white people, hated Jews, and hated America," unquote. Oh, so very true. So very true. Also a drunk and an adulterer and a plagiarizer. All of his speeches, "I have a dream, woohoo!" All those speeches were all plagiarized. Just the lowest of the low. And there's actually a whole huge holiday around him. And he's become a god in America. We have to worship him. It shows how sick this country has become. It really shows how sick, and he was a communist. It shows how sick this country really has become. Thank you, Chicago Jew. And we go now to the great Lewinsky Stinks, Dr. Brennan Rocks, who writes, and I quote, "French whites are using muzzies to do their dirty work," unquote. Absolutely true. Absolutely true. The European whites in general, they support the Muslims against Israel because they want the Muslims to destroy Israel. And I think Lewinsky Stinks here is referring to the Muslims that murdered the 4 Jews in that kosher delicatessen in Paris. You know, the French, traditionally, French and Europeans have hated the Jews for 2,000 years. They murdered the Jews. And, you know, now they have the Muslims coming in and attacking Jews. And they always love when the Muslims do this to Jews in Israel. But what they wish on the Jews is actually what's going to happen to them. Actually, everything they're wishing on the Jews, midah keneged midah, means measure for measure. God will repay them. Everything they want to happen to the Jews is going to be happening to them instead. And Lewinsky Stinks now writes, and I quote, "Putin as Magog," unquote. No, I don't think Magog, of course, is the, it's Gog. Magog is the country. Gog is the leader. Actually, no. I don't think that Putin would be Gog, because Putin is the leader of Russia, and Russia is a paper tiger. They do have nuclear weapons. They have thousands of nuclear weapons. That's true. But Russia's economy is being shown to be so vulnerable, and they are so far behind. They are like 1,000 years behind. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but they're way behind the Western world in everything. You remember when they had the Olympics, and they spend billions of dollars on trying to put together the best looking Olympics to impress people with the new Russia of Vladimir Putin, and they couldn't even get the athletes clean drinking water. The water was filthy, was horrible and polluted and terrible. The athletes would say, we can't even get decent drinking water here. It's so terrible. We can't even shower. The water is so terrible. We can't even take a bath or take a shower. The water here is so disgusting. You know, I mean, you didn't have any water to brush your teeth or to take a shower or to take a bath or to drink or to do it or cook with. It was so disgusting. And this is after they've spent billions putting together everything. The one thing, they couldn't get the water to work right. They still, the nasty, polluted water of Russia. Even the athletes were exposed, and the media that was there were exposed to the nasty, polluted water of Russia. Russia is so far behind the West, and it has such a terrible economy and such a terrible society because of the effects of communism and many other things in Russian history. I don't think Putin and Russia could become the powerful nation that will become the superpower that will be dominant in the world. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't know if it's going to be the United States. I don't know if it's going to be China or some other country. I don't know. That I don't know, because it could happen 100 years from now. It could happen 200 years from now also. That's possible also. It may not happen in the near future. But I don't think it's going to be Russia. Not with their history. The majority of Russian males are alcoholics. And I'm not exaggerating. The majority of Russian males have very serious drinking problems. The majority. I mean, how can you build a healthy society like that? You can't. Lewinsky Stinks now writes, and I quote, "What will the New World Order religion be?" Unquote. They already have a religion. I think their religion is the new age, these new age cult. You know, they have these new age cult type religious beliefs. Some of it is like witchcraft and Satanism, and a lot of these New World Order people are into that. They think that's cool, the New Age thing. Yeah, oh yeah, it's cool. They think it's they love the New Age cult type so-called spiritualism. So my guess is that's what it would be. And Lewinsky Stinks now writes, Lewinsky, a bigger anti-Semite than the French, unquote. Lewinsky Stinks is referring to Bibi Netanyahu. His policies on Jewish building in Judea, Samaria, and Jerusalem are more anti-Semitic than the French. Do the French tell Jews you can't build here because you're Jewish? You're not allowed to build a house here because you're Jewish? But Netanyahu and the Israeli government tell Jews, and this present government, and Naftali Bennett was part of the government, the so-called right-wing government, they have the anti-Semitic policy of saying a Jew is not allowed to build in his homeland just because he's a Jew. If you're an Arab Muslim, you can do anything you want. A Jew cannot build. You're a Jew. Obama doesn't want you building in Jerusalem. Obama doesn't want Jews in Jerusalem. Because you're a Jew, you're not allowed to build there. I mean, it really is more anti-Semitic than the French. It really is. Thank you, Lewinsky Stinks. And we move on now to our great friend Binyamin Yisrael, who writes, and I quote, "One, you also passed through Delaware when taking Amtrak to Washington, D.C. Wilmington, Delaware is a stop on the line," unquote. Okay. The last time I took the train was in the 1980s. I honestly don't remember. But I only remember driving through Delaware on the highway, and as I mentioned last week, I remember stopping in a gas station in Delaware. But I don't know. I don't remember all the stops on Amtrak going from New York to Washington, D.C. That I don't remember. But interesting. Okay. Benjamin now writes, too, did you take Amtrak to places other than Philadelphia and Washington, D.C.? If you did, what are the places did you go to on Amtrak? Unquote. I used to take Amtrak from New York to Boston because we had a very active JDL chapter, an excellent JDL chapter in Boston in the 1980s. The head of JDL was the late Ken Sidman, Zichrono Livracha, may his memory be immortalized, Alav HaShalom, may he rest in peace. Wonderful Jew who unfortunately passed away, died of a heart attack in 1987. Ken Sidman was an outstanding JDL activist and a black belt, by the way, in karate, and a very, very skillful fighter. Very tough guy. And he had a great Boston JDL, and we used to go up there all the time. You have to remember that in the 1980s, when I was running JDL, this is before the era of the internet. We didn't have the internet, so we had to go in person in order to reach people. If we wanted to speak to people, reach people, unless you do it by telephone, but, you know, you can't run things by telephone. It's not really the best thing to do. Before the era of the internet, you really had to do a lot more traveling and had to meet people in person. So I traveled several times in the 1980s up to Boston and to be with Ken Sidman and the Boston JDL, and we had speaking dates there and activities there, and we even a couple of demonstrations there. And I remember traveling from Amtrak from New York to Boston. It was a nice trip. A very nice, very nice trip. I enjoyed traveling, even though there are a lot of problems with Amtrak. And it's unfortunately subsidized with taxpayer dollars, which is very problematic. But I always enjoy traveling on Amtrak. I mean, I have fond memories of the trips. I used to enjoy those trips. Thank you, Benjamin. And we move on now to the great Manch, who writes, and I quote, one, PP begged to attend Paris Farce. What would you do as prime minister, unquote. Absolutely obscene what Pepe did. You're right. He wound up marching in a parade, supposedly against terrorism. And in the parade was Mahmoud Abbas Abu Mazen, who murdered far more terrorists than the Islamic State, than ISIS or the Islamic State or Hezbollah. Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, together with Yasser Arafat, murdered far more people than Hezbollah and Hamas and ISIS and Al-Qaeda ever dreamed of murdering. And he was smiling. If you go to you'll see the article on our news site. This is one of the reasons why people must go to our news site every day. You should check our news site out. You can scroll down, you'll see the article where you see, or you'll see it on our Facebook page. You'll see it on our Facebook page. And you'll also see on our news site, you'll see a picture of it, where we're on our English Facebook page, where Mahmoud Abbas Abu Mazen is smiling, is laughing. He's marching and he's smiling. Everybody else is very somber because it's after the murder of all these, slaughter of all these people in Paris. And he's marching and he's laughing and smiling the whole time that he's marching. I mean, this is so obscene. And Bibi is marching several feet away from him. You know, they're all locked arm in arm, and Bibi is marching several feet away from him. What a disgrace. What a disgrace. I'd never march in a parade with a bunch of terrorists and Jew haters and filthy Nazi pigs. I would never do that. If I were prime minister, I would tell the Jews of France to get the hell out of France and come to Israel as quickly as possible. I would say that France is a Nazi country that murdered 250,000 Jews during the Holocaust. It was the French police and French soldiers and French civilians who rounded up the Jews and put them on the trains to the death camps during the Holocaust. The French did it, not the Germans. The Germans murdered them in the death camps. But the French are the ones who rounded them up and sent them to the death camps. 250,000 French Jews were murdered by the French themselves. Cowardly collaborators with the Germans. And I would tell the Jews of France, this is who you're living amongst? Are you crazy? Get out of there and come home to the land of Israel. And welcome. We will welcome you home. You're welcomed in your homeland. Come back to the land of Israel. Come home. That's what I would tell the Jews. That would be my message to the Jews of France. And my message to the French people would be, you have a terrible history. If any of you are righteous or fear God, you will oppose the policies of your evil government and you will support Israel. Every human being in this world, Jew or Gentile, is obligated to support Israel and support the Jewish people. That God commands us to do, demands that of the Gentiles in the Bible. And my message to the people of France and the people of every nation of the world would be the same message. I will bless them that bless thee and curse them that curse thee. That's the message of the Bible. That's what I would do as Prime Minister. I would tell the truth and I would open up a huge campaign to get Jews in France and Jews from all over the world to come back to the land of Israel, come home to the land of Israel. And I would tell them, now you're going to have a free market economy with lower taxes and a real Jewish state and real Jewish security and an army and a nation you can be proud of. This is the time to come home. Mansch now writes, and I quote, to Danino, Temple Mountain, existential threat to Israel, unquote. Yes, it's also an article that we had on our news page, Mansch. I'm just mentioning this, Mansch, because it's important that people, you know, I keep repeating, it's important that people go to our news page every day. And yes, and I'm glad you're bringing it up. Danino is the police official, the head of the Israeli police. And he said that Jews going to pray on the Temple Mount, on Har HaBayit, the holiest place in the world for the Jewish people, if Jews dare to even utter a prayer there, that's an existential threat to Israel because you're going to annoy the Arab Muslim Nazis. The Arab Muslim Nazis can go there and have two mosques there and openly incite and pray for the destruction of Israel and burn Jewish flags and wave the flags of all the terrorist flags. They bring the terrorist flags with them there as part of their so-called prayer services. But Jews are not allowed to even utter a prayer there. Jews are arrested if they utter a prayer there. Jews are blocked from praying on the holiest spot in the world for the Jewish people. I mean, what a self-hating, insane government we have in Israel. And this is the guy, Danino is the guy who's supposed to be heading the Israeli police force. He says this is a threat to Israel's very existence that Jews want to pray on their own Temple Mount. It's not the Arabs that caused this threat. It's not the fact that we have Arab terrorists and traitors like him running the police. That's not a threat to Israel. No. It's the fact that we have Jews who want to pray on our Temple Mount. That's a threat to Israel. The fact that we have Jews who haven't surrendered like he has. That's the big threat to Israel, according to him. So, what can I say? It's unbelievably evil. And Mansch now writes, 3, Jimmy Carter, Israel is more dangerous for Jews than France, unquote. Well, you know, Jimmy Carter is a Nazi, and, you know, he's like the current Nazi we have in the White House, Barack Hussein Obama. And Jimmy Carter just wants to destroy Israel, destroy the Jewish people. That's what he's always wanted to do. Remember that when he ran for president, we warned people 1976 when he was running that he's a Jew hater, and the majority of American Jews, of course, supported him. And, you know, his grandson ran for governor of Georgia. You don't think the Jews in Georgia voted for him last year when he ran for governor of Georgia? I'm not surprised that there are Nazis and Jew haters out there. There always have been. That doesn't surprise me. What disgusts me, frankly, is the self-hating Jewish reaction to all of this. That's what disgusts me more than anything. Thank you, Mensch. And we move on now to our great friend Da Vinci, who writes, and I quote, your thoughts on retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson, unquote. Okay, very good question. I'm glad that we're able to speak about this subject. We're starting to speak about the subject. I hope we'll be doing videos on this. If he runs for president, we should be doing videos on it. This is a black neurosurgeon who made one speech criticizing Obama, and all the Republicans are saying he should be the candidate for president now. This is a guy out of nowhere. He happens to be a neurosurgeon. He's black. He made a speech criticizing Obama, and right away they want him now to be the Republican nominee for president. For president. And polls show that a lot of Republicans say they'll vote for him for president now. It's unbelievable. This guy is such a joke. First of all, one of the things he did, I mean, he makes statements that are so outrageous. One of the things he did, he defended the black monster Ray Rice. You remember Ray Rice? The athlete who knocked his wife unconscious on the elevator? You remember that? Remember that we actually saw a film of it, and he just belted his wife and knocked her unconscious, and, you know, this big, powerful athlete belting that woman, he knocked her unconscious, he could have killed her. He could have killed her. And, you know, what does Ben Carson say about this guy? He's a black, of course, Ray Rice is black, naturally, and his wife is black. What does Ben Carson say? We shouldn't demonize him, he said, because we're all human beings. In other words, let's understand, and we're all human beings, let's not demonize him. That's what Ray Rice said. In other words, I mean, that's what Ben Carson said. In other words, Ben Carson is, let's face it, Ben Carson has sympathy for this type of evil black violence against women and black behavior. The blacks, the Arabs, the Muslims are monsters toward their women. Monsters. Only a monster would belt his wife and knock her out cold on an elevator like that and practically, he could have killed her. Only a monster behaves like that. And Ben Carson is saying, we shouldn't demonize him. We shouldn't demonize him. He has some problems, some issues that he has to settle. We shouldn't demonize him. I mean, it's obvious that Ben Carson doesn't think this is so terrible. And Ben Carson also said, when he was asked about that on the Bill O'Reilly show on Fox Television, he said that he, as a teenager, tried to stab someone. So he was part of this violent, evil culture as a black teenager. He once tried to stab someone. So he said, because he tried to stab someone, he sympathizes with people who behave like this. Let's understand something here. Let's understand something like here. Something about this guy. He is not moral when he makes statements like that. He's making excuses for evil behavior, even though he claims he's not excusing it. Of course he's excusing it when he says you shouldn't demonize him. You should demonize him. He is a demon. And he's a candidate for president? Why? Where did this guy come from that people want to make him president of the United States? The most powerful person on the face of the earth? They want him to be president? Not that he'll ever get elected. Of course he has no chance of ever getting elected. But large numbers of Republicans in polls say that they want to make him president of the United States? What an insane country this is. How insane people are. The only thing Ben Carson does is take votes away from Ted Cruz. He takes votes away from Ted Cruz. So hopefully he won't run. And of course we support Ted Cruz for president. Thank you, Da Vinci. We go now to the great Dr. Dan, the voice of reason, common sense, and logic, who writes, and I quote, 1. Why is gas so cheap now? Unquote. Because of something that we were urging for decades. I mean, we've been speaking about this since the early 1970s, that America has the ability to put the Arabs out of business. We could put the Arabs and the Muslims out of business completely. We have enough energy resources in the United States to easily achieve that. And we've said that since the 1970s, and people mocked us and said, you don't know what you're talking about. Geologists and this expert and that expert say, no, it's not true. Now we see it's coming true. What did we speak about in the early 70s? What was JDL always speaking about? What did I always speak about on my television program? What did Rabbi Kahana speak about? We spoke about shale oil, things now like fracking. We didn't have the term fracking, but we spoke about how we can extract oil, coal, all these natural gas, all these other energies. We have enough to put the Arabs and the Muslims out of business for good. Because of fracking and because of shale oil and because the American energy industry is finally decided to start doing exploration, which could have been done decades ago, and let no one tell you otherwise. I mean, we transferred for nothing. We have sucked the blood out of the Western world and transferred trillions of dollars to the Muslim world for no reason. And they continue to get away with this highway robbery. It's the biggest robbery and transfer of money in world history by far. But because of fracking and because of shale oil, the United States was creating a surplus of oil on the oil market, and that surplus was drove prices down. Now, the Saudis were urged by the Iranians and others to stop this by cutting back on oil production. They decided, instead of doing that, they refused to cut back. They wanted to drive oil prices down. Why did they? This is a little complicated, what I'm going to say now, but I'll try. Let's try to make it as simple as possible. Economics is a complicated subject. The Saudis don't want oil prices to be high right now. Because if oil prices are high, like they were over $100, right, over $100 a barrel, when they're over $100 a barrel, that makes it profitable for American companies to go in and research how to do clean coal and fracking and shale and all the other things that they're doing. That makes it profitable, and then that eventually will put the Saudis out of business and put the other Muslim countries out of business. So the Saudis don't want it to be profitable for American domestic producers to go in and do those things. And when it was $100 a barrel, it was profitable. So the Saudis deliberately want to drive the price down so it becomes less profitable. If the price is now below $50 a barrel, it's much less profitable for American producers and American entrepreneurs and for American domestic companies to go in and to do shale and to do fracking and to do these other things and to do clean coal. It's much less profitable for them. So the Saudis want it to be less profitable because they want less American energy production. They want to make sure they don't lose their markets and that they still, and that a huge percentage of the world market continues to be in the hands of OPEC and of the Muslim producers, the Muslim bloodsuckers. They don't want America to take up that market and to take business away from them. So they deliberately want to keep the price low so that it's not profitable for American producers to go in and do that. And they're succeeding. American producers are cutting back because of that. The Saudis are taking a beating temporarily. I mean, the prices are lower. And so they're not, well, I say they're taking a beating. They're still making money. They're still making profit. But they're making less profit than they would make if prices were higher. But they're willing in the short term to get lower prices and less profit and not lose their market. They're willing to do that. And that's what's going on right now. That's why you see prices so low right now. Because there's a surplus of oil on the world market. And when there's a surplus and when there's plenty of oil to go around, prices go down. When there's a shortage, when there's less oil to go around, obviously prices go up. And that's true not only with oil, basic economics 101, that's with any commodity or any item or anything you want to buy in any market, in any free market situation. So that's what's going on with gas right now. We have the ability, and always have had the ability, to put the Muslim terrorist oil-producing countries out of business and to destroy the Islamic terrorist threat. We would cripple them. We would cripple them in every way if we eliminated this oil threat and really if America became the energy producer of the world and America became the Saudi Arabia of the world. We could cripple the Muslim world's ability to threaten all of us. And this is something we've been saying now since the early 1970s, when the Arabs started using the oil blackmail that they were using. Since then, this has been our message, and, you know, once again, we were proven right. We were proven right by what's going on now. Dr. Dan now writes, and I quote, to talk about Mayor Weinstein of JDL, unquote. Well, you know, I don't like what he's done, and I don't like what he stands for. I don't want to get into a big feud with Mayor Weinstein now. It's not worth it. You know, he's not important enough. But he doesn't, it rubs me the wrong way as someone who was one of the major figures making JDL a famous organization. Obviously, my bombings made JDL world famous. The vast majority of JDL bombings I did personally. So obviously, I had a lot to do with making JDL a world-famous concept. And when people took this name, people like Irv Rubin or Mayor Weinstein or others, they took the name and they completely distort everything it stands for. Obviously, I'm not happy to see that. The JDL, formed by Rabbi Kahana, was a Torah organization. Everything Rabbi Kahana did was based on the Torah, was based on the Bible and the Torah and the laws of God. And anyone who moves away from that is distorting and actually is distorting and actually twisting the Kahanist message. And they should not have the name JDL. It's really a disgrace that they're misusing the name JDL. I'll give you just an example, one issue. And I saw your question, Dr. Dan, and that's why I bumped up an old thread we had about this, a thread from about 6 months ago, I think. 6 months ago, a year ago, I don't remember. But you could see it on our, if people go to the forum, they could see it there now in our general discussion section. It's a thread about how Mayor Weinstein supports a Jewish so-called gay group that promotes homosexuality. He supports the group. He praises the group. As the head of the JDL, he's praising this Jewish so-called gay group. This is unbelievable. You know, Rabbi Kahana would turn over in his grave if he heard this. This group, this evil group, has signs that say, and I quote, "Oy vey, I'm gay, 100% kosher," unquote. In other words, it's 100% kosher to be a homosexual deviant, to be a sodomite, to practice something that God in the Bible and in the Torah refers to as a toeva. Toeva is abomination. It's one of the few sins in the Bible where if someone persists and is defiant and refuses to stop and tries to encourage others to do it, eventually the punishment is stoning to death. Person should be stoned to death eventually. Sikul in Hebrew, sikul, which means the punishment of being stoned to death. It's one of the very few mitzvot, commandments in the Bible, which is so serious, violating is so serious that if someone persists and refuses to stop, they can, and there are witnesses that they continue with this after being warned. Of course, they have to be given a warning and have to be given another chance and has to be explained to them and so on and so forth. Has to be explained to them what the penalty is going to be if they persist. But if they persist, eventually they have to be stoned to death if they continue. So this is a really horrific sin that Hashem does not have any tolerance for. Any tolerance for. And Mayor Weinstein is endorsing a Jewish group, so-called Jewish group, that promotes this, that tells Jews that this is good, that tells Jews this is something wonderful and that it's kosher, quote unquote. That's just one issue out of many where people like this have taken the name JDL and they're trying to turn the JDL into the ADL. That's what Mayor Weinstein and Irv Rubin and others have done. They made the JDL into the ADL. They made it like a left-wing Jewish establishment group that caters to the low-life, degenerate views of assimilated Jews so that the assimilated Jews are not turned off. They don't want to turn people off. And, if we don't stand for the truth, even if it's unpopular sometimes, if we don't stand for the truth, if we don't do what Hashem has commanded us to do, then we have no business calling ourselves a Jewish organization at all. Because that defeats the whole purpose of why we're in this world, of why God put us in this world. And Dr. Dan now writes, "Where can I find the Village Voice interview of Reuben badmouthing Kahana?" Unquote. That I don't know exactly where I know it's in the 1980s that he did an interview where he said that he wouldn't sit Shiva or Shiva, if he would say Shiva, but in the real Hebrew it's Shiva, that he wouldn't sit Shiva if Rabbi Kahana dropped dead. That was the quote. I don't want to tell you which book it's in. It's also in a book that was written. I don't want that book publicized. It's a terrible book. I don't want to tell you. I don't want to publicize the book. But believe me, he did say that in the Village Voice. And he did give this interview. He told everybody that he hated Rabbi Kahana. He always hated Rabbi Kahana. So there's no question. I mean, there's no question that this took place. And that not only that, Rabbi Kahana, in that same article, it says correctly that Rabbi Kahana threatened to send Bob Manning out to physically take care of Reuben, to physically deal with him physically. And Reuben got very worried when that happened. I mean, it's just, the whole thing is just, Irv Rubin, just to give you a couple of quick reminders of what Irv Rubin represented. He created something called Los Angeles JDL. Complete distortion of what the JDL was supposed to stand for. He made a so-called JDL that Hollywood would love. He honored Hollywood actors and actresses who were intermarried, assimilated, Jewish anti-Semites, the worst scum of the earth. As long as they were in Hollywood and famous and would give him a contribution, he honored them. He did an interview on the Merv Griffin show. Merv Griffin had a big program on television in the 1970s and 80s. 60s, 70s, 80s, big show on TV. He actually had 30 million viewers. Don't forget, this is pre-internet when television was the main source of communication in the world was television in those days. And Merv Griffin had one of the highest rated shows on TV in TV history. He had 30 million viewers on his show. And in front of 30 million people in the 1980s, Irv Rubin came on the show and said that Jonathan Pollard, the Jewish hero Jonathan Pollard, should get the death penalty. Let me tell you something. Anyone who stabs a Jewish hero like Jonathan Pollard in the back in front of 30 million people and tries to incite 30 million people against Jonathan Pollard saying he should be killed, he deserves a death penalty. Anyone who does that to Jonathan Pollard, in my opinion, deserves no mercy. In the end, God gave Rubin the death penalty in prison. What he wanted to do to Pollard happened to him in the end. He was a horrible person. Roseanne Barr, who made Hitler cookies, a Jewish, so-called Jewish woman who said that Israel should be destroyed and she's against Israel and Zionism and there should never be a Jewish state, there shouldn't have been any Israel. Roseanne Barr, and who made Hitler cookies and dressed like a Nazi to show how much she hates her own people. This beast was honored by the Rubens, honored by Los Angeles JDL. That's the type of people they gave honors to as long as they were famous and from Hollywood. Would Rabbi Kahana do something like that? God forbid. I mean, just horrible. I remember when Rabbi Kahana told me to form Jews Against Jackson. Jesse Jackson was running for president. Rabbi Kahana said, he's an anti-Semite, you got to form Jews Against Jackson. Rabbi Kahana said, he's not going to get elected. Jesse Jackson's never going to get elected president, but he's going to pave the way for eventually, he said, in the future, you're going to see a black candidate run because Jesse Jackson's going to pave the way, make it respectable. So in the future, you'll see a black candidate who doesn't speak like Jesse Jackson in Ebonics and who will sound more acceptable and more presentable to whites, but will have the same anti-Semitic, anti-white ideology as Jesse Jackson, and that black candidate will get elected president someday because we're allowing Jesse Jackson to have legitimacy. That's what Rabbi Kahana warned about with Jesse Jackson. And of course, we ended up getting that with Barack Hussein Obama. Rabbi Kahana, his predictions have all come true. And I remember Irv Rubin holding up, Irv Rubin apologizing to Jesse Jackson and saying that being against Jesse Jackson for president is racist. And how all the L.A. and Hollywood left-wing Jews, oh, they loved that. They loved hearing Rubin say those things. I remember him burning a Confederate flag. He said the Confederacy is this. He buried a Confederate flag with a swastika. He said the Confederate flag is just like the swastika, which is a lie. In other words, antagonizing all the Southern white people, many of whom are evangelical Christians who support us. In other words, he was kissing the behind of all the black Jew haters and all the Hollywood self-hating Jews, but attacking the evangelical Christians and the Southerners, the Southern whites, who, generally speaking, are our best friends. Those people he was attacking. That's Irv Rubin. And Mayor Weinstein loves him. I mean, just, I could go on and on. When Mayor Weinstein was confronted with the fact that he was, you know, what Rubin said about Pollard. Mayor Weinstein said, well, I was never fond. I never cared about Pollard either. I never liked him either. Imagine this. The nerve of this guy speaking like that about a Jew who has spent 30 years in prison because he loved the Jewish people and wanted to save the Jewish people. And this guy has the chutzpah to badmouth him and then say, Rubin, no, I agree with that. I never really cared about Pollard either, he said on this other website of so-called Kahanists, where he was writing. Anyway, Dr. Dan, what can I tell you? It's unfortunate. It's unfortunate. I hate to get bogged down in this because it's nonsense, but we stay true to our principles. As long as we're around, there's going to be someone who's going to say what Rabbi Kahana really stood for and what Torah Judaism really stands for. Whether it's popular or not, we're going to stand for what's right. Thank you, Dr. Dan. And we go now to our great friend Kalman Ben Menachem, who writes, and I quote, Reb Chaim, French Jews want permission to carry guns. The Simon Wiesenthal Center says only the French government can protect them. Your thoughts, unquote. Oh, well, we saw how the French protected the Jews during the Holocaust. The Simon Wiesenthal Center protected Nazi war criminals. There was a book written by a reporter, famous book written by a New York Nazi Times reporter, actually. Even he wrote this, showing how Simon Wiesenthal protected Kurt Waldheim, the Nazi war criminal, made an agreement with him just so that he would let him have his center in Vienna, Austria, Nazi Vienna, Austria. And he protected all the Austrian Nazi war criminals and said they were all fine. No, they're not Nazis. No, they're fine. Simon Wiesenthal Center is an organization of traitors, complete traitors to the Jewish people. And the Simon Wiesenthal Center puts JTF on their hate list group. We're a hate group. Arafat is not. Arafat and the PLO terrorists, they're not a hate group. No. Jesse Jackson, that's not a hate group. No. They love Barack Hussein Obama. He's wonderful. But we're a hate group. Ach, what scum. Thank you, Kalman. And we go now to a new friend of ours, a truth seeker, who writes, and I quote, Israeli politics may not be totally hopeless. What do you make of Bayit Yehudi? Best of a baddish bunch, unquote. No, not at all. I think Habayit HaYehudi is a very bad group. Naftali Bennett, the head of this group, says, among other things, that 99.9% of the Arabs in Israel are loyal to Israel. That's a statement he made. 99.9% of the Arabs in Israel are loyal to Israel. I mean, how can you get worse than someone who says that? 99.9% of the Arabs are loyal to Israel. It just so happens that 95% of the Arabs in Knesset elections vote for Knesset parties that openly call for the destruction of Israel. Where does he see these Arabs who are loyal to Israel? I don't know where he sees them. I don't know where he's finding them. This is a completely phony group. By the way, Habayit HaYehudi means the Jewish Home Party. That's the translation into English. Complete phony. Completely fake. And they do not offer the answers to our problems. It's the same thing as Netanyahu, the Likud, Sharon, all the other people on the phony right. They're all part of the same group. In the end, they wind up doing even more damage than the open left. Thank you, Truth Seeker. We go now to the great Paper Cut, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, Mia Love and Trey Gowdy voted to keep John Boehner as Speaker of the House, even though they claim to be Tea Party politicians, unquote. Oh, okay. I'm glad, I've been so busy with so many things I've been doing in Israel. I wasn't even aware of that. Thank you, Paper Cut, for letting me know about that. That is terrible. John Boehner is a traitor, a complete traitor, a disgrace. And Mia Love, for those of you who don't know, is the new black Republican congresswoman from Utah. Trey Gowdy is a Republican congressman from South Carolina. And many of the conservatives and Tea Party people love them. They voted for John Boehner as speaker. You're absolutely right. That is absolutely outrageous. I agree with you completely, Paper Cut. Thanks. Thanks for letting us know about that. We go now to our great friend, South Korean Zionist, who writes, and I quote, please talk about the rise in jihadists and chaos in Libya since the U.S. took out Gaddafi. Is it good or bad for Israel, unquote. Well, I mean, obviously, when Muslims kill each other, that is good for Israel and for America. But the problem is, when Obama intervenes, Obama's interventions and the interventions of the United States in general in the Muslim world have generally been bad. Instead of removing the Iranian nuclear terrorist threat, which is the number one Islamic terrorist threat in the world, ISIS is not, Al-Qaeda is not the big, really gigantic threat. And I'm not saying Al-Qaeda is not a threat, it is a threat. But the most horrific threat is the threat of them getting nuclear bombs and killing millions of people. And Iran is on the verge, God forbid, of getting that. And Obama is helping them. And the same thing George W. Bush helped them. And George W. Bush took out Saddam Hussein, who was not, who didn't have weapons of mass destruction, and he said he was going into because he had weapons of mass destruction. It was a lie. He didn't have any. And is letting, and then told Israel, don't take out the Iranian nuclear bomb-making program. So when the U.S. intervenes in the Muslim world, usually it is not good for America or for Israel. When the Muslims are killing each other, and if they have a dictator like Saddam Hussein or Muammar Gaddafi or some other dictator, and they're slaughtering each other, let them kill each other. The only time that you intervene is if they pose a threat to, if they pose a threat to us, then we intervene. Like with the Iranian nuclear program. With the Iranian nuclear program, we should go in militarily and destroy that program because that is a real threat to us. But unless they're a threat to us when they're fighting each other, let them kill each other. What are we getting involved? Why do we get involved? We should not get involved. And Obama has continued the policy of constantly getting involved and making things worse. In country after country, he has gotten involved and he has made things worse, whether it's Libya or Syria or other countries or Iraq, he makes things worse. The more he gets involved, the worse it is. Thank you, South Korean Zionist. We go now to the great EB22, who writes, and I quote, why do you think Barack Hussein Obama's approval rating has gone up significantly, despite him having a horrific job performance as ever in recent weeks, unquote? Okay, good question. And the answer is because of the drop in oil prices. Because of the drop in oil prices, that's given a temporary lift to the economy. The economy is still in terrible shape. But the drop in oil prices is just a slight relief for some of the consumers, and I think that's what's behind it. I don't know, by the way, that his approval rating has gone up that significantly. He's still, right now it's about 50-50 in terms of people approving, disapproving. So I don't know if it's going up that significantly. But it's definitely the drop in oil prices that has done it. Thank you, EB. We go now to the great Tag Mechir Tzedek, who writes, and I quote, why did Avraham protest God's plans for Sodom, but did not protest when he was told to bring his son up as an offering, unquote? Okay, excellent question. God told Avraham Avinu, Abraham our father, he told Avraham Avinu that he plans to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah means Sodom and Gomorrah. God tells Abraham this. Abraham is a prophet, so God communicates with Abraham. Whenever God communicates with somebody, that means that they're a prophet. If God is, when I say communicate, I mean directly tells them something. When God tells them something in a dream or communicates with them in a direct way, I don't mean through action, through some action that you see God did a miracle and it's indirect, you're not directly getting a message from God telling you something, but when he directly communicates and says something to you, whether it's in a dream or in some other way, that means that you're a Navi, a prophet. Abraham did not protest God's plans. We don't protest against something God does. That we don't do. God is absolutely perfect. He never makes any mistakes. He never does anything wrong. Everything he does is perfect and correct. But God wants us to pray to him and to intervene with him in certain situations. Like if the Jewish people are in trouble, we're supposed to pray to him to try to reverse that bad situation. So why do we pray to him? Because our prayers, just the fact that we're turning to God and praying to him, gives credit, puts more points on the side of not hurting Israel and not punishing Israel. The fact that someone is turning to him and praying to him. And that's why we're supposed to do that. We're in this world to pray, to act, to live in order to make it a better world. And part of that process is praying to God and turning to God and asking God to help and asking God to do good things and asking God to intervene for the righteous and against the wicked. That's part of the process. So that's what Avraham did in the case of Sodom and Gomorrah, of Sodom and Gomorrah. He was not praying on behalf of the evil people in Sodom and Gomorrah, not at all. his prayer was, if there are 50 righteous people, will you destroy the righteous with the wicked? In other words, if destroy the just wicked that are being destroyed, he had no problem with that. His concern was, what about if there are 50 righteous people? And then he said, what about if there are, and then he went down the list on, what about there are 45 or 40 or 35 or 30, and went down the, and kept reducing the number, and God said, no, I won't destroy if there are 30 righteous, if there are 20 righteous, and so on. So, finally, when they got down to 10 righteous, and God said, no, there are not even 10 righteous people there, Abraham finally dropped his objection, his concern and his prayer, and realized that Sodom and Gomorrah had to be destroyed. But he was praying just in case there were righteous people there who would get caught up and would get destroyed as well. That's what he was praying for. He was praying on their behalf. You ask, why didn't he do this when his son... Then later on, God commands Abraham. God commands Abraham to sacrifice his son Yitzchak. Isaac, Yitzchak. Why didn't he turn to God or say anything? Why did he immediately obey and say, yes, okay, right away get ready to do it without saying a word. Immediately accept this. First of all, we have to understand that what God did when he asked Abraham to sacrifice Yitzchak was a punishment. God was punishing Abraham. It was one of the 10 tests, one of the 10 nisyonot, the 10 tests that Abraham got in the Bible. There were 10, he was tested 10 times by God. And this was the 10th and final and most difficult of all the tests. Why was God punishing Abraham? This was actually also a punishment. Why was God punishing Abraham? And making him go through this obviously torturous process. Because Abraham made a deal, made a brit, a covenant, with Avimelech, the king of the Plishtim, the Philistines, and legitimized Avimelech and the Philistines being in the land of Israel, and was willing to share sovereignty with them in the land of Israel under this agreement that he made with Avimelech. And Hashem was very, very angry at Abraham for this, very disturbed. You're not allowed to make any agreements on the land of Israel with any other nation. The land of Israel is for the Jewish people to have. It was given by God to the Jewish people forever, for as an eternal covenant. The Jews are not allowed to say, we're gonna share this land with the Philistines or with the Arab Muslims or with any other evil, with all these other evil nations. They're not allowed to do that. This land was intended for the Jewish people and the Jewish nation. And when Avraham Avinu, for the sake of peace, for the sake of good neighborly relations, was willing to have a brit, to have a covenant with Avimelech, the king of the Plishtim, the king of the Philistines, that angered God. And right after that, immediately after that, and this is what Chazal did, this is not Chaim ben Pesach saying this, I wouldn't dare to start explaining these things on my own understanding. What is my understanding? This is based on what Chazal teach us, what the rabbinic sages in the Talmud teach us. And what we learn in the oral law. Hashem was angry with Abraham for this, and so immediately after that came the test of offering up his son as a sacrifice. Now, the interesting thing about him offering up his son as a sacrifice, Abraham knew that he was being tested. That doesn't mean that Abraham didn't think that, in the end he would have to actually go through with it, is that the test would be that he would actually have to kill his son. He might have thought that that's what, and he was willing to do it. If he had to do it, he was willing to do it. There's no question. He was willing to do it if he had to. He almost did do it until the angel came and told him, Abraham, don't touch him, don't do anything to him. But until the angel came and stopped him, he was there with the knife and he was ready to kill his own son and offer him as a sacrifice because God told him to. Because Abraham showed that he believed with emunah shlema, with perfect faith, that whatever God commands, there's a good reason for it. And even if he doesn't understand it, that's not the point. When God commands us to do something, if God is commanding us to do something, there's a good reason for it. Abraham understood that. And that was the test. And Abraham knew he was being tested, and he knew it was a difficult test. But he knew that he had to be willing to pass that test. And he might have also known that he was being punished for what he did with Avimelech, with the king of the Philistines. And might have thought that this is the punishment that I have now, and this is the punishment that's upon all of us now because I did this. So, that's just, again, and his son, by the way, Yitzchak learned the lesson. His son Yitzchak refused to make any covenant with them. Refused. They wanted to make a covenant with Yitzchak as well. Yitzchak refused. Yitzchak wouldn't make a covenant with them. So, because he knew he was being tested, and because he knew, and because it was a punishment, it was not the same situation as the situation in Sodom, where Abraham was trying to see if there are any righteous there to save the lives of the righteous, but there were no righteous there to be saved. Thank you, Tag Mechir Tzedek. We go now to the great Nekama, who writes, and I quote, "One, John Baird of Canada is a truly righteous Gentile," unquote. I think that his positions on Israel and Iran are certainly better than that of the other politicians. I would agree with you. He's relatively good for Israel and for the Jews. And compared to the left in Canada, I think he's probably better for Canada too, although on at least one issue, he takes a position that is not good. He supports same-sex marriage. That's bad for Canada and bad for any country. That's a shame that he takes that position, but he does. And there are people on the right in Canada who have run against him, actually, and have complained about him. By the way, John Baird, for those of you who don't know, is the foreign minister of Canada. And he just went to Israel, and they wanted to throw stones and eggs at him. I would agree, on Israel and on Iran, he has taken a position that, relatively speaking, is better for Israel than that of the other politicians in Canada. I would agree with that. I would agree with that. I'm disappointed that he supports same-sex marriage. That's a shame. Okay, Nekama now writes, 2, generally it seems the bigger the Shvarza female gorilla, the bigger the attitude. Why? Unquote. Oh, I don't know. Maybe they're, I really don't know, but you might be right about that. You might be right about that. I've certainly seen my share of big gorillas in my life. It may be that because they're bigger, they feel that they can be more intimidating, and they feel that they could, get away with it. They could get away with being more outrageous. It may be just because they physically feel that they're more capable of pushing their way around. Maybe that's what it is. Thank you, Nekama. And now we go to our great friend Maimonides, who writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim, is deflation or inflation the major problem facing the U.S. and overall world economy?" Unquote. I don't know. I'm not sure. Either one of them can be a very serious danger, obviously. Obviously, if we suddenly have inflation now with a very delicate economy, it could cause an economic catastrophe if all of a sudden inflation starts. If interest rates all of a sudden start shooting up, interest rates are near zero in terms of the Federal Reserve level, they're near zero. So the benchmark and the benchmark rates are very, you know, very, very low. What happens if interest rates start going up? What happens if inflation starts going up? It could be very, very dangerous. But deflation, we know from history, is also very dangerous. And the drastic drop in oil prices, the sudden drastic drop, can possibly lead to deflation. We had deflation during the Great Depression. That can be very, very destructive. So there's no question there's dangers from both. I don't know which is going to be more of a danger in the future. I honestly don't know the answer to that, Maimonides. Either one of them potentially could be very dangerous for the economy. Thank you, Maimonides. We go now to our great friend Imaknik, who writes, and I quote, "Why are there more evil people in the world than the righteous?" Unquote. Because it's easier to be evil than to be righteous. First of all, we have two competing inclinations in our body, or in our soul. It's actually in our soul. One is Yetzer Hara, which means the evil inclination, and one is Yetzer HaTov, which is the righteous inclination. In someone's soul, deep down, there's a righteous desire to, because there's an understanding that we got to do right things and we better do what's right and we're creatures of God. That's the righteous inclination. It's our righteous inclination is idealistic and selfless, and we feel the pain of other people and we're concerned about other people. We want to do good. That's the righteous inclination. The evil inclination is selfishness and ego and cruelty and sadism and jealousy and all the other bad characteristics and pride. That's the evil inclination. And that's more connected to the body, to the physical things in this world. For the first 13 years of our lives, for men, for boys, and for girls it's the first 12 years. But for the first 13 years for boys until the bar mitzvah, we basically are dominated by the evil inclination. For instance, when someone's a baby only has the evil inclination. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's a case where the evil inclination, the bad inclination, is necessary for survival. We need both the bad and the good inclinations for survival. For instance, we need to be selfish enough to want to eat in order to survive. Otherwise, we'd never eat. If we were just so righteous that we'd never wanted to eat, we would die of starvation. So we need some of both. But we need to use them and channel them in the right direction for good purposes. Even the bad inclination, quote unquote, can be used for good purposes. But when a baby is first born, a baby only wants attention and only wants to eat and only wants to be paid attention to and changed and pampered and all the other things that babies want. And that's what we expect out of a baby, and that's perfectly fine. A baby is not blamed for that. That's perfectly acceptable. But we're born with that, and then we expect all our lives to be pampered and fed and everybody taking care of us and all the attention and everything, the whole world's centers around us. That's what we expect to go through our whole life with. That's the evil inclination, when we never grow out of that and understand, hey, wait a minute, there are other people in the world. I have to be concerned about other people. I have to be concerned about what they want, how they feel. The good inclination really starts kicking in only later on when somebody grows up. In the beginning, a child starts out with the evil inclination only. And so the evil inclination has a head start on the good inclination. So the odds are already against the righteous inclination in people. But if somebody studies the words of God and the Bible or has enough common sense to understand that we have to be righteous and we have to do what's right, it is possible to overcome that. But it's not easy. It's not easy. It's always easier to be selfless than to be selfish. It's always easier to be egotistical than to be righteous and kind and truthful. And it's always easier to go down the easy path in life. Because, we're told that we have two paths. In the Talmud, it teaches us we have two paths in life that we can go down. The evil path is smooth and easy in the beginning. Smooth and easy and pleasant and all these pleasures and all these other things in the beginning. Smooth and nice and easy. And then in the end, it's very bad and very rough and gets only worse, and forever it's just terrible. That's the evil path. The righteous path is very rough and very painful and very difficult and full of struggle in the beginning. But in the end, forever is smooth and wonderful beyond imagination. The problem is most of us can't see far enough into the future to see what the righteous path leads to and what the evil path leads to. And so most people take the evil path, which seems so smooth and so easy in the beginning. That's why there are more evil people than righteous people in the world. Thank you, Imaknik. And I want to thank everybody for another program that I very much enjoy doing. Until next week, Shalom.